Hey everyone, it's the summer of fun at CyberTap. In our special shortened summer season, we're watching movies, we're going outside, and talking summer cyber projects. So let's go. Welcome to the summer season of the CyberTap. Welcome to another episode of the CyberTap. Hi Mike, how are you?
I'm doing all right. You, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, we're still hanging in there, right? So it's still a crazy world. It doesn't, and I think we're a month removed from our last episode, and I would say the world has gotten no less crazy, but things are good here in beautiful West Lafayette, Indiana, home of the Purdue Boilermakers. I'm excited to see some things kicking back up in the sports world. I see that they've made some decisions about NCAA football, and recruiting continues, and basketball and all that stuff is kicking back up.
Well, initial decisions. I'm guessing there's going to be some additional changes as we get closer and closer to the kickoff of the season.
Yeah, you're probably right about that, but I'm hopeful and thankful that they're looking like they're going to give it a go. So that's exciting, but I think what's exciting is what's right in front of us today, and this is our latest edition of the CyberTap. And so if you don't recall, our summer series is all about having fun in the summertime. So we have segments about cyber projects, things to do that are cyber related or technology related. So for that segment that we're getting right into right away, we've brought Matthew Crane. Matthew Crane is one of our security analysts from our CyberTap team, works with George. George is one of our regulars on this podcast, but Matthew's on George's team, goes out and does security risk assessments, helps with curriculum design and all sorts of education and professional cyber services. So Matthew, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, gents.
Well, it's great to have you. We wanted to bring you on the show because you have what I think, and I think Mike, you agree, and I know our producer Jim and technician Eric, we all kind of geek out about some of this stuff. You have a really interesting cyber hobby. I don't know if that's the right way to classify it, but you're a 3D printer.
Yeah. I've been for the last couple of years experimenting with all sorts of new 3D printing technologies and learning all I can about it. It's, I guess, cyber related. I mean, you do
technology,
plug it into a computer at some point. So yeah, but it's a weird little bridge between the cyber world and the physical, since you're actually creating objects to be passed around. So yeah,
is this for entertainment purposes for you, or is it more educational? Kind of, how did you get into it?
Well, entertainment, really. I have been involved in modeling and miniature painting for a long time. I started out building model airplanes when I was a munchkin, and lately I've been assembling and painting tiny little figurines to fight battles across imaginary battlefields and realistic tabletops. And there are a lot of projects that lend themselves really well to being augmented with 3D printed objects. And so I have started to experiment with creating models and designing terrain pieces, and it's sort of expanded from there.
So earlier I said you're a 3D printer, and that's not to say that you are an actual printer. You're a human being. I just wanted to clarify that. But you are one that prints in 3D, making you a 3D printer. But the question I have is, how many actual printers do you have, and can you tell us a little bit about those?
I have three at the moment. The earliest that I have is a SparkMaker 3D full high definition, or FHD. That is a resin printer which uses a photopolymer to turn ultraviolet light into tiny little highly detailed objects. That printer was a Kickstarter printer. It was billed at the time as the least expensive resin printer available. And 1 year past the date when they were supposed to have delivered it, it turned out to be almost the least expensive printer available at the time. I replaced that about 4 months ago with a new Anycubic Photon S, which is another resin printer, another very high definition, very finely detailed surfaces, but smaller project sort of printer. Much, much nicer than the Spark Maker, primarily because it has a little bit better control over exactly how stable the build platform is. It, since the printed objects are printed layer by layer, if there's any sort of movement other than what the printer intends, vibration in the environment, so on, then the print can start looking pretty weird pretty quickly, and the Anycubic is much more stable. And my latest printer is a brand new Ender 5. I treated myself to it for my birthday recently. The Ender 5 is an FDM printer, filament deposition, which means that rather than that photopolymer resin I was talking about, it uses a spool of plastic filament and heats that up and melts it and sort of toothpastes the line of melted plastic into the structures that you're building. Very, very different technology than the resin printers, generally used for larger scale, lower surface detail, but a better structural properties, so you can use it to make tools and physical objects that aren't going to just shatter if you drop them, which is a real problem with some of the resins I've been using.
So you talked about stability being an important aspect with these printers.
Sure.
I'm guessing you don't have them sitting on top of a washing machine or a folding table. What does your environment kind of look like in order to get the best product out of these printers?
Well, so work in progress there. I'm also a woodworker. And so marrying the high tech and low tech there, I'm building a much more solid and heavy table than they're currently residing on. Right now they're on a desk, but the good news is the desk is sort of an L-shaped computer desk. And so since it's not one plain straight folding table sort of thing, it's actually much more stable than it might be. And than it could be. But you want to try to make sure that it's not sitting on top of your washer. That's an excellent suggestion, Mike. you want to make sure that it is in a relatively dust-free area, since with the resin printers, there's some cooling of the light source, and so fans could suck in dust and gum things up that way. With the FDM printers, dust could settle on the build surfaces, or particulate could settle on the build surfaces. And depending on what you're trying to do, even small irritants like that could result in some weird effects. You do have to kind of be aware of what your environment is like when you're setting these things up. Last up with the FDM printer, it's actually pretty sensitive to ambient temperature. I have chinchillas, and so I've got the apartment relatively chilly, which means I have to have a little bit less cooling near the printhead to keep the temperatures up where I want them to be while the thing is running. So,
With your printers that you have, Matthew, how large of things can you print? What's the scale that you could print at?
Oh, yeah. So with the resin printers, we're talking relatively small. The dimensions of the build platform on the resin printers are about the size of a medium-sized smartphone screen, because the light source that they use to make each of these layers is shown through an LCD panel that was originally intended for a smartphone. Hmm. And so we're talking something like 200 millimeters by 100 millimeters, maybe, as far as XY. In the Z, I think it can get 200. I don't actually remember the specs. I can look those up. The filament deposition printer, the Ender 5, is much, much larger. That build platform is about 300 millimeters cubed. So we're talking a relatively, I mean, you could print out something the size of a soccer ball relatively easily. Now, obviously, there are other printers out there that have all sorts of different kinds of capabilities. I mean, someone last year 3D printed a boat, if I remember correctly. And so the same sort of technologies scale up very well, but at some point you got to ask hard questions about where you're going to put it in your house.
Right.
I've got more of a desk-sized sort of production facility at the moment.
I'm kind of assuming, and I don't know much about this, but I'm assuming there's kind of a big community of makers that are into 3D printing. And tell us a little bit about like what you've seen out there, kind of people sharing, you know, the how-tos or design, model designs, or what's the community like in the 3D printing world?
Well, the one word answer is crucial. Most people's ideas of printers come from like the desktop printer that they have in their office, right? You dump a Word document into it and it spits out a sheet of paper and it looks exactly like you expect, barring like low toner or whatever.
Right.
3D printers are really, really new technology. I mean, they've only really become widely available in the last couple of years. And there aren't a whole lot of standards that have been accepted. It's sort of the Wild West as far as the manufacturers are concerned. Mm. And so the community is absolutely crucial for you to get anywhere. The two places that I have gone to get most of the support and knowledge that I have obtained, there is a website called Thingiverse, and we should share the link in the show notes. Thingiverse.com. It is a file sharing site for creators to share the designs of the objects that they've made. And my 3D design skills are pretty rudimentary at the moment. So all of the complex and interesting things that I have printed so far, I found on that and similar sites.
Sounds like that's the follow-up to Napster.
A little bit, yeah. Only you remember where the movies they said you wouldn't download a car. Well, people are downloading cars,
right?
But one of the cool things about Thingiverse, there are all sorts of crazy things that people have already designed. Whether they'll be simple models or they'll be a kit that you could use to build a desk-sized version of the components to a tourbillon watch, all sorts of crazy things. Each of those projects has also got all sorts of tips and tricks and details for how those designers think that you would go about printing those objects. Lots and lots of useful information there.
What's your favorite thing what's the favorite thing you've printed? Like if someone says, hey, you do 3D printing, show me something you printed. What's the thing you grab off the shelf or whatever? Be like, oh, check this out.
Well, right now on my desk at work, I have got a 3D printed version of a giant robot for one of the miniature games that I've been playing. It's called an Imperial Knight. And I printed it laboriously out of tens. I don't think it's hundreds of parts, but certainly tens of parts. A tiny little laboriously printed object and assembled into this enormous, almost a foot tall, stompy robot sitting on the shelf above my desk. That's pretty cool to show off.
All right. Conversely, what have you printed that you thought was going to be really, really cool and it turned into like a blob of just awfulness?
Almost everything I ever printed. Yeah. Like I said, it's not very turnkey at the moment. Lots and lots of variables. And so when I was first learning about the resin printers, trying to figure out how long each slice needed to be exposed to the UV meant that I was printing a little too long, so the layer was blooming, or I was exposing a little too short, and so that layer didn't really adhere very well. And so probably every single thing I've printed, I have had some false starts. Most recently, I said I acquired that Ender 5 FDM printer, one of the reasons the Ender 5 is such an exciting printer for the community is it's sort of a kit, and lots of people have all sorts of ideas for how to modify it. And mm-hmm. so I have been trying for a couple days now to try to print out supports, to try to make the print bed a little bit more rigid. And like I said, trying for a couple days, those have not worked out very well. They've turned into an enormous tangled, matted spaghetti scribble twice now.
What's next for you on 3D printing? So where do you go? Like, what are you looking forward to? So for your kind of home 3D printing world?
Well, so I'm pretty early in the journey with this new FDM printer, and I know that there's a bunch to learn. The default material that you use for that printer is called PLA, which is a pretty flexible plastic material. They're pretty much all plastic materials. But there are a bunch of different materials, and I've heard that, is it PTEG? There's another plastic that you use higher temperatures with, but that results in flexible prints, not rubbery, but much stronger prints. And so the next project is to try to figure out what I would need to change to be able to use that material and go even farther into building physical useful objects in the real world. I have got my eye on some more building projects to help finish off my woodworking area, tool hangers and organization sort of tools. And it would be nice to print out exactly the specific thing I need rather than nailing things into the wall. So
what is PLA? Yeah. Do you know what that stands for? Is it?
Oh, sadly, I don't.
Polylactic acid is what I just looked up. So I used the internet, yeah, folks, because I didn't know. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't the Chinese People's Liberation Army. So
no.
Different thing. No. Okay, good. You're not using.
I mean, my suspicion is it's significantly easier to melt this kind of PLA.
That it is the People's Liberation. I don't know.
Hard to say.
We'll stick with 3D.
Your mileage may vary.
That's right. Well, Matthew, thanks for kind of walking us through what you're working on, some of the things that you're doing in 3D printing. It's not something I've gotten into at all, especially in the home base. You know, Purdue does a lot of research around composites and printing materials and things like that. And I've seen a lot of their lab spaces, but haven't got it in home. Got into it at home at all.
I'm curious, as somebody who would be new to this hobby, what kind of expenses should they expect for startup and ongoing cost?
Yeah, good question to finish this up.
I would recommend thinking around the $500 mark. If you are going to be starting out, there are almost certainly cheaper printers. But like I was describing with my first printer, it ended up being relatively terrible compared to a printer that was just $100 more. So I would think around the $500 mark. That's going to give you a printer and some supplies to start out with, like a printer and a couple spools of filament, which will give you plenty of material to make your mistakes on first. And budget for some mistakes. There's a learning curve at the beginning of this process. So,
all right. Well, it's not a small barrier of entry, that's for sure, but not too bad either. So, you know, the homemakers can, not homemakers, that sounded weird. The makers that do things from home.
Yeah.
They can get into it. $500, not too bad. Well, thanks again, Matthew. Appreciate your time today joining us on the podcast. It's always fun to hear what our team is doing around the house. But we want
it'd be cool if you could make a couple figurines in my likeness and Matt's likeness. So
that would be amazing. That would be amazing.
Well, when we can get back into the office, maybe we can take some high resolution photos and see what we can do.
All right. We're going to hold you to that. Don't think that we won't. Sure. We're pretty vain over here on this podcast. We want our own action figures, is what Mike's really saying. Well, thanks again,
Matt. I can do.
Thanks again. We're gonna jump topics now. We're gonna move over to our movie review. So we had Matthew on to help us with 3D printing, and we're bringing producer Jim on to help us walk through our latest movie review. And we watched Snowden, Mike.
We did. Yeah, named for the individual. Yeah. Edward Snowden, as if anybody didn't really realize that.
I think if you're listening to a podcast about cybersecurity, you're going to know who Edward Snowden is. It's one of the bigger names in cyber and privacy that we've had in the last decade, right? So we debated whether to watch this movie, but we said, you know, why not give it a try? You know, last month we reviewed Sneakers, and one of the things that I loved about that and transitioning to watching Snowden is that the NSA and the CIA both represented Sneakers. If you listen to our last episode, we talked a little bit about that. And at one point, the NSA representative said, well, we don't spy on U.S. citizens. And I thought that was really interesting. And then, you know, the whole premise of that movie, again, spoiler alerts for all these, is that they were trying to obtain a box that would allow decryption of any U.S.-based, you know, cryptography codes and things like that. It was, obviously, it's a movie, but it was it leads itself nicely into the Snowden film, where we now know maybe the NSA does do a little bit of surveillance on U.S. citizens. And so we're wading into a pretty controversial topic with this movie, but we're going to give it a try. So, Jim, thanks for joining us and kind of help guiding us through our review of Snowden.
Yeah, happy to be here. So I guess the one thing surrounding Snowden the most is I feel like whatever political side you're on, there's always contention on what Snowden did. So let's start with, did you think that the film had any bias either way on Edward Snowden as a person?
What do you think, Mike?
As an individual, I don't know. It's hard to say. I think they very much used his girlfriend, which is now his wife, Lindsay, I think, as the liberal side of the equation. And maybe she truly is in real life. I don't really know her. I've never really read any articles about her. But he was very much the opposing side, and he kind of transitioned slowly as the relationship went on, or quickly, depending on whether or not you're looking at a movie timeline versus the years that this spanned over.
I thought
it was okay. I didn't think it was like in your face, his transition from his views.
No, and I thought that, and I don't know if that's more for Hollywood or if that's reality, what he thinks. And I haven't seen enough content directly from him to know, but they definitely showed how he moved from a more conservative mindset, more patriotic mindset, to becoming what I truly believe he thinks, you know, that whistleblower, right? Someone that was morally obligated to bring light to these programs that the government was running. And I thought, from my perspective to your question, Jim, is I thought there's definitely some bias in the film. I think it's hard for us, any of us, to remove any bias from any creativity that we do, or you know, anything that we create. So I would say there's bias, but I thought when it wasn't as bad as I expected. I expected it to be just full of, you know, propaganda. I don't know why I thought that, but I did. And I didn't think it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. So I thought the bias was there, but I thought I could see, I guess, an attempt at some fair storytelling.
Yeah, I went into it thinking it was going to be very biased, and I was kind of pleasantly surprised that they left that part out and kind of focused more on the storytelling. Do you think a follow on to that, then, do you think they did a good job addressing the ethical issues surrounding what he did? Because there's also contention there. What you know, if what he did was right or wrong.
I don't think that they did, actually.
I agree.
Because they at the end, this is spoiler alert again, at the very end, they actually transitioned into Edward, the actual individual.
Real man, real Snowden.
The real individual speaking. And so I feel like they probably wanted to placate him or play nice to him on his views on what he did. As a tech person, you know, he was in a position where I felt he should have done the right thing from a moral, from an ethical standpoint, and he didn't. He purposefully stole documents in a manner giving him, because of his permissions and things based off of his job requirements, And I have a hard time with that.
Yeah, so yeah. I also have a hard time with it because I filled out a lot of that same paperwork and made those same agreements with the federal government that he did. So my time in the Department of Defense and the intelligence community, you know, it was required me to have a security clearance and have access to information that it's very clearly stated that if you share this information, you know, you can be held accountable under, you know, treason. I mean, really, it's an act of treason to share things. And so I thought the movie itself could have done a little bit better job showing that, you know, the choice he made really has kind of two big, you know, opposite kind of views. Right. So is it his moral obligation to be a whistleblower because he sees things are unconstitutional? But then what about the fact that, you know, he's made this agreement and he's also allowing our, you know, our enemies and other nation states to understand some of our abilities and doing some things that really probably hurt the United States intelligence community in some ways. And it just, you know, he says things negative about the Espionage Act in the film. But the Espionage Act is an important act, right? We can't have people spying or becoming double agents in our intelligence community. That just undermines what we do. And I'm not saying that he did that. And actually, just talking from the film perspective, I think the film could have done a better job of looking at both sides of that.
So what was the most absurd thing about the movie then? From a cybersecurity standpoint, from a just the plot, the whatever, what was the most absurd thing
you guys? Well, there's two that come to mind, but I know there's one that we all said, oh my gosh, we're making that into the podcast. I don't know which one you want to talk about, Matt. I'll let you go first and I'll fill in whatever you don't talk about.
Right in the beginning, there was a bunch of cheesy like spy tradecraft when Edward Snowden, the character and the man in real life, travels to Hong Kong to start kind of releasing information and to begin blowing the whistle, I suppose. There's a bunch of cheesy tradecraft. I think they're in a mall or something. I don't remember. And he approaches the media folks that he's arranged to meet there in Hong Kong and asks like ridiculous questions like, what time does the restaurant open? Noon. But the food is too spicy. And if maybe they really did that, but I thought it was like the cheesiest, like spy tradecraft. It was more get smart than it was, so, you know, real spy tradecraft.
It's a little Hollywood. Yeah,
that was real. That one just made me laugh out loud. And unfortunately it kind of set the tone for the movie for me in some ways. Cause I was like, oh Lord. But yeah, that's one I picked out, Mike. What about you?
All right, I'll go with the obvious one where they're in Hong Kong. They're in a hotel room, and I think they've invited one of the representatives from The Guardian, which is the news outlet that exposed the documents and the stories.
Yeah.
And there's already some independent reporters that have been with Snowden having some early conversations. And so Snowden is sitting on the bed cross-legged with his laptop. And I guess the new individual from The Guardian requests some amount of information, some kind of proof of something. And so Snowden, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is the actor playing Snowden, yeah, grabs a giant large red blanket and basically creates a little tent fort around himself to hide him and his laptop. And so you get a quizzical look from the new individual and they say, what is he doing? It's like, well, he's really secure minded and he's hiding. He's making sure nobody steals his password.
He's protecting his passwords by putting a blanket over his head. So that now I guess there's a camera in the room. Right. But there's probably some better ways to protect your
There's additional shots of them in this room where he's on his laptop where he's not having that kind of protective nature. It seemed a little bit ridiculous to me.
It was a little over the top.
Yeah. Just the way it was filmed, too. It made it a bit silly. And let's not, you know, I don't want to answer too many questions in advance because, Jim, I'm not sure what you're going to ask us. But another ridiculous thing in this movie is Nicolas Cage.
See, I didn't think there was enough Nicolas Cage.
I don't know if it's
I wanted more Nick Cage.
I don't know if it's ridiculous or it was the best thing about the movie. I'm torn.
Well, his presence was puzzling because usually Nick Cage is like the title actor. And in this case, he was
two scenes.
An extra. Like
two scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's the title actor 25 years ago. He's not the draw as of late, but.
And they weren't stealing any government document. Well, I take that back. I guess they were stealing government documents, but not the Constitution. So
that's right.
And I did also have a concern. I would say concern, but it's a ridiculous nature. And it wasn't a cyber related, but it was the relationship beginning between Snowden and Lindsay, where they, I don't know if it was a blind, I don't know how they got together, but there was like their first date. And it's very, very clear that they have opposing political views on everything. And it starts off kind of light banter, and it turns into almost like an argument as they're walking down the street, as they see protesters
on the first date. Yeah.
On the first date. And so they're like arguing at each other in the middle of the street. And the immediate resolution is that they start making out.
Yeah. I think Oliver Stone wanted to get through it. Like, yeah, he just wanted to get through that part where, okay, they have a complex relationship. So we're going to have it on date one after meeting in an online dating service or something like that.
In a 30-second scene.
Yeah. And, we don't agree on anything. Let's kiss.
So what are your thoughts then on the ratio of nudity to national security? Because this movie
I would say that it wasn't a ton, but completely unnecessary for this film.
Oh, like, out of place and unnecessary.
Yeah, I think I read that. Was it Shane Woodley who plays Lindsay?
Shailene Woodley. Yeah,
Shailene Woodley. She actually never was in any contact with Lindsay to figure out what her mannerisms and things were. So they based a lot of her character on just her social media posts, Lindsay's.
Yeah.
As it turns out, that individual posts a lot of herself in artistic manner.
Yeah, she's a
poses, outfits, artist. Lack of outfits, however you want to talk about it. But there was a few scenes where you saw a lot of permanent art fixtures around their house that's of herself in these kinds of poses. So.
Well, and I'll just say this. This movie is not a sexy film. There doesn't need to be sexiness, frankly. Like, it's just not that. Like, it's Snowden. He's a whistleblower. It's about privacy. It's about the United States government collecting information and how they use it, and is it right or wrong? And it's a divisive topic. And I don't think of, like, romance and sexiness when I think of Edward Snowden. Maybe I'm alone in this, but that's just me.
So who do you guys think the best cast character was? That I think they did a pretty good job casting Snowden, personally. But, who do you think was the...
You got the voice right of Edward Snowden, that's for sure.
Like I said, I don't know too many of the individuals beyond Snowden. But I thought from an actor perspective, and I'm going to butcher the name, but the Reese Ifans.
Oh, yeah. Reese, I think, or something.
Reese is... Okay. He's been in a lot of other... character. I think he did a really good job on portraying whatever that character was supposed to be. It was kind of he was the governmental official. He kind of headed up a lot of the programs that was doing the spying.
I was gonna say the same thing. I think he was probably my favorite casted character. We kind of, when we watch these movies in our viewing parties, we do a little, what is that, mystery science theater 3000 we gag on the movie, like we kind of goof through the whole thing. And I mentioned, if you don't know who this Reese Ifans, I don't know how you say it either, Mike, to be honest, he was the kicker in The Replacements that always smoked on the field. The Replacements is a football movie with Keanu Reeves, if you don't remember that one. It is a good flick, and I liked him in this too, and I thought he had some of the best lines. One of the lines he said was, "You don't have to agree with politicians to be a patriot." And I thought that was pretty insightful, because I consider myself a patriot, but I rarely agree with politicians. And so I thought that was good. But they kind of teed him up to have be an interesting character. But he's kind of okay with the spying that the U.S. was doing, which was interesting. But I liked his character too, and I liked his casting. Well, who else, Mike? Who else did you like in the film?
Oh, man, it's hard because this is one of those films that I find interesting, but not necessarily entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I enjoyed parts of it, but as a whole, this is not a movie I would ever watch again. It's not a movie I would have enjoyed if I'd gone to the movie theater and paid $26 or whatever it is they cost nowadays.
Yeah, I don't even know.
So I don't know. I kind of have a mixed feelings on the movie, and so yeah.
There was
he
some...
was the one character I did actually thought did an excellent job. I said the Stone one was okay. I don't think any of the reporters really, they were just kind of generic to me.
I thought Zachary Quinto played Glenn Greenwald, who was one of the key kind of journalists that helped expose the Snowden stuff. And so I thought he had some scenes that were really good. I think when he was playing hardball with the Guardian, do you remember the scene where he spits all over the place? He was really into it right then. And I thought he had some scenes that he was pretty good in it as well.
I'm still disappointed by the lack of Nicolas Cage. I really thought he was going to play a bigger role.
I usually like Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe it was his character written in a way that it just wasn't really palatable.
Yeah.
Yeah, a fairly small role, too. Didn't give him much.
And that's part of it, is that it was a lot of, other than like three or four of the core cast, everybody else is really small parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So my last question to end it, is Edward Snowden a hero or a villain?
Oh, man, the loaded question right there. Mike, what do you think? Yes.
Good show, everybody. All right.
So he exposed something that clearly was a violation of our rights. And I guess I see that as a hero's act, supposedly, but the mannerisms in which he did it, I consider to be a villainous. So it's a mixed bag for me. Is there a way he could have exposed that information in a better way without stealing it and publicly putting it out on a news outlet? And then hiding off in Hong Kong and Russia.
Well, I think you sum up kind of the controversy around Snowden is even in the media, it's like one day he's a villain, one day he's a hero. And I think everybody's kind of on that fence.
Yeah. The from a film perspective, they made him out to be a hero. And I think they, obviously that was purposeful. They chose to show him as the whistleblower that he is. And I believe that I get the sense, or I believe that that's, was his motivation. I don't know. I don't know the man, and I'll never sit down and talk to him and ask him truly what is his motivation off the record, where he can maybe unfiltered, or what he believes his motivation was. But at the end of the day, the amount of information that was put out there hurt the intelligence community. And not just, hurt us from a perspective that we were doing some things that we shouldn't have been doing against the people and citizens of the United States, but it hurts our ability and hurt our ability with, enemy combatants of the U.S. So if you look, Al-Qaeda would say that they have looked at the Snowden documents, and they now better understand how the NSA and the CIA do things. And that hurts us. And so from that perspective, I think, as Mike, you said, he could have done some things better. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not in his shoes. It's really hard to say because, your life is on the line, right? So the penalty for treason can be death. And so he made the decision to do what he did, and he probably felt compelled to put that much information out there just to overwhelm maybe the airwaves and things like that. I don't know. If he does less, does it work out as well for him? I mean, I don't know. It's really hard to say. But at the end of the day, I think he brought to light some things that we need to be concerned about as U.S. citizens, about our own government collecting data against us. And I think privacy is going to continue to be such an important issue, not just from a government perspective, but how we interact with technology, how we interact with companies, things like that. And I think it was important to get it out there. But at the same time, I wish that it was done in a way that maybe, like Mike, you said, maybe didn't hurt the United States intelligence community and our ability to operate in a really hard environment, in a really strange world where we need to have collection going on against, our enemies, whoever they might be.
And I will say, I think it opened a lot of people's eyes to their own privacy and their own security, because before that it was always just a conspiracy theory that the government was collecting everything you did on your cell phone. After that, anybody you talk to is now aware that, hey, ho, they joke like, oh, they're listening in on your phone calls, or yeah, hey, they know your text, So I think from an awareness standpoint, a cybersecurity awareness standpoint, it did a world of good for the general population.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. If I met Snowden, I'd probably thank him and then tell him he needs a spanking, and Oliver Stone would probably want to and Oliver Stone would probably want to film that. So
yeah. I wanted to ask the actual scene of the intellectual theft. It seemed incredibly basic and easy. And I'm guessing this is close to what actually happened. But basically, there was some event going on. So I guess the precursor is that he started working as a contractor with Booz Allen Hamilton in Hawaii, but had clearance to access NSA information that was like hosted in Maryland or something. And he was kind of a system administrator role, so he kind of had godlike permissions to everything.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So some other incidents going on, and so the rest of the group there is distracted, and so he basically pulls out a flash drive. Sticks it in, does a mass copy paste, and sticks it over. Now, about 6,000 windows pop over the files transferring, which is a little ridiculous. But
well,
basically, it got it on the flash drive, and then he just walked it out inside of a Rubik's Cube. I mean, is that something that legitimately could happen today?
Can you copy 1.5 million files in about 90 seconds? I don't care what machine you're using, right? He was just using a terminal like that was connected into the system. He wasn't using a supercomputer to do it. He threw a thumb drive, a flash drive, and copied 1.5. And that's an estimate. I don't think we really know. I think the United States government says they estimated 1.7 million files. And that wasn't just U.S. files. There was things that had to do with the Five Eyes intelligence community. And if you're not familiar with that, that's the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. And so there's a signals intelligence collective, and we share intelligence with those nations, and they share with us. And a lot of those files belong to those folks, or were intelligence gathered by those countries as well. So it just wasn't the U.S. But can you copy 1.5 million files in 90 seconds? I feel like there was probably a little bit more of a lead up, you know, and a little more effort. And no doubt Snowden's a smart guy, and so he probably did something programmatic to dump a bunch of files. But yeah, that scene was completely unrealistic to me, because you like you said, you're not going to. It literally showed hundreds of copy and paste windows popping up on his screen and copying these files over very quickly. He certainly wouldn't have done that through a Windows interface, most likely, and he would have done some things, you know, with Linux and been smarter about how he copied that. So I think, yeah, that was.
Do you think today they've done a better job of air gapping those types of systems?
No, so
you can't do that kind of.
I mean, the systems are air gapped, right? So when I worked in this space, you know, I managed 3 enclaves at the same time, unclassified, secret, and top secret. So that's not abnormal for someone to have administrative control on all of those systems. And as a systems administrator in some of these, or systems architect, engineer, whatever my title might have been, I had access to a ton of data. Absolutely. Because like we do even in the corporate world, somebody has to have control. And control who can access what, and that falls on the IT staff quite often, or the cybersecurity or information assurance team, or whoever it might be. And so people do have keys to the kingdom, and to be able to access a lot of data, yeah, it's definitely possible. And what was interesting about this one, you know, sensitive compartmentalized information, that's an SCI clearance nomenclature. So if you have a top secret clearance with SCI, you get read into compartmented programs, and those are designed to protect data. So if I don't need to know, I don't have access to that particular program. And so there's these silos of information, but this whole program was about the collection of data. And so they had tons of data in one spot. And so, yeah, he would have had access to a lot. And there's only so much you can do about that. You just try to put controls in place where, you know, you can trust the people.
So the big question is, would you recommend this movie for others to watch?
No, I wouldn't. I would say go read some books on Snowden if you're interested. Like, find some legitimate, like, not a Hollywood retelling. I would say go find, and I don't know, I should have looked him up, been more prepared. But I feel like now I want to go do a little bit of more of my own research so I can formulate a better opinion. And this movie's not the place to do that. So I don't recommend it.
Yeah, if they would have gone a little more documentary and less sensational, then I think it would have been a little bit better. But I think they tried to put a little too much Hollywood in it, which to me ruined the feel.
Yeah, I was using a decision tree. Do you already know the story? Do you like Oliver Stone? If either of those questions are no, then don't bother.
Oliver Stone had some good movies, though, right?
He does. No, he does. Yeah.
And so, and I like a lot of them. But I don't, I mean, yeah, again, I'm a no on this one just because I don't think it was a necessary story for Hollywood to tell. I think it's interesting and I think it's probably worth looking into, but I just wouldn't use Oliver Stone Snowden as the basis to do my research or learn more. All right. Well, Jim, I think we're all on the same page here about this movie. It was interesting. It's an interesting story. No doubt about that. The movie's okay. But probably wouldn't watch it again. But thanks for joining us, Jim, and helping us walk through
Appreciate the
snow. Yep. Oh, I got to say the joke here. It's a dad joke. Thanks for helping us wade through the snow, Din. Oh, that was terrible. All right. Well, let's go outside.
Well, actually, Mike, before we get into our go outside nerd segment, there's something I wanted to let all of our listeners know. So right now, if you are part of an Indiana company, so a company in Indiana, you can actually train on the Purdue Cyber Range for free. Yeah, that's right. Free, Mike.
Free?
So, I know.
We
it's
don't
great.
Do anything for free.
Well, you can actually train thanks to the Next Level Jobs Grant. So this grant is an Indiana Department of Workforce Development grant, and it will reimburse your company up to $5,000 per person and up to $100,000 per company. So you can imagine there are some restrictions and some program requirements that apply. So I'd encourage all of our listeners that are in Indiana that are interested in this grant to go check out nextleveljobs.org. If you're interested in training on the Purdue Cyber Range for free, we will help you with the application process. We'll help you navigate how to get the reimbursement. We'll help you develop a custom designed and required training plan. The great thing is that every one of our range scenarios, every one of our badges and our entire series can be taken at essentially no cost because of the Next Level Jobs grant. Again, that's nextleveljobs.org. If you want to get started with us on this training adventure, what I would encourage you to do is reach out to us, cybertappodcast@purdue.edu, or you can fill out our contact form on our website, which is cyber.tap.purdue.edu. So again, those websites for Next Level Jobs, it's nextleveljobs.org. You can email us at cybertappodcast@purdue.edu or hit us up on our website, cyber.tap.purdue.edu. So Mike, I wanted to get that plug in because free training is great and we would love all of our listeners to have an opportunity, but if you're in an Indiana company specifically, we can get you fully reimbursed for up to $100,000. So it's just a great opportunity. Wanted to share that with our listeners. Now,
how long does that offer last?
That's good for the year. So you can do up to $100,000 reimbursement if you get it all scheduled and done before the end of this year. And after January, it drops down to a $50,000 total corporate reimbursement. And that has to do with the CARES Act and from the COVID crisis and all these things.
So get in early to get your money.
Yeah, that's what I would say for sure. So it's a great opportunity. We'd love all of our Indiana listeners to get a chance to train on the range. And speaking of training on the range, we're actually bringing in for the next segment one of our trainers, Jeremy. He's a technical instructor with the CyberTap. He is probably he's our second in command range officer. So George, who most of you know if you're listening, George is our range officer. He's the one that is in charge of the Purdue Cyber Range. But Jeremy is his right-hand man, one of our technical instructors that handles a number of our programs, some of our large industry-sponsored programs, our public offering. And Jeremy is one of our range trainers as well. But we're not bringing him in, Mike, to talk about range training because Jeremy is also a disc golfer. And that's what we want to talk about for our Go Outside Nerd segment.
Pretty sure he's a semi-pro disc golfer.
This dude,
skill level.
So this dude is serious. We'll talk a little bit about that. But Jeremy, welcome to the show. It's good to have you.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Mike. I will actually agree with Mike and say semi-pro at
this. He's not modest.
Not modest.
Yeah, you know.
Well, let's we're going to talk a little bit about disc golf and get into it. But Mike, why don't you tell the listeners about our disc golf outing, how it was set up and how we challenged Jeremy and then what the outcome was.
So we're trying to find activities that we can actually accomplish, you know, being semi-pro athletic for some of us and not so athletic on some of the others. And also that the weather has shifted here in the location, and you go outside for about 5 minutes and you're drenched in sweat. So trying to keep that in mind as we do activities. So it was a little touch and go initially, I think, on whether or not we could get this accomplished, but we got a good enough day, I think. And we decided, you know, we're going to go out and we're going to disc golf. So we got four of us as a group. So it was myself, Matt, Jeremy, and producer Jim. Decided to go out to one of the local parks, which is free. There's no setup. There's no cost. There might be some maintenance that the park does. The city. I don't know if that builds into the taxes, and it's way above my
whatever. Yeah,
my knowledge level. But as a consumer, there's no cost for you to set up for the range. So we went out. I have my own discs. Although when I say I have my own discs, that it pales in comparison to what Jeremy says he has his own discs. But
you and I have a little bag of, you know, 10 discs or something each, which is a lot for people that don't play often, I thought. But Jeremy brings out a truck full of like a hand truck full of discs. How many discs are in your bag, Jeremy?
There's probably 25 to 30 in there.
Exactly.
And how many of those do you actually go through in a single round?
You know, in a single round, I could actually go through most of them. Even though there's 25 to 30 discs in there, the different number of molds I have is really only about five.
So before we get into like that stuff, let's, Mike, keep telling the listeners about what we did.
So the course that we went to does have 18 holes or 18 baskets or 18 driving ranges, whatever terminology that you want to use. But disc golf is very much scoring like regular golf. You start at a tee, you have a distance, you have directions, you have obstacles, and then the hole or the pin or whatever you want to call it is actually a basket. So it's a large metal chained basket. Some courses will have what they call tone poles. Most of those are just a singular pole that's usually metallic base that you can just hit your disc off of, and that's the same as getting it in the hole.
But good courses have baskets, right? I mean, that's,
And so, obviously, the goal is to get your disc into the basket with the least number of throws.
Right.
So, anyway, we did the traditional 18-hole course for – I think it's the only 18-hole that I'm – no, actually, we have another course that's 18. But the one we chose was that as a community park or city park. We actually started on hole 5.
Yeah, there's some construction we had to work around, but we still played all 18.
Yeah, so we started on 5 and we worked all the way back around. We played kind of a 3v1.
Right. So it was you and Jim and I versus Jeremy.
And I guess I should also mention that there are different tee spots, starting tees. So there's the pro tees and then there's everybody
amateur
else. Amateur tees. So we made Jeremy throw from the pro tee and we threw from the amateur tees, which gives us a little closer distance.
That would add anywhere from, you know, 30 to 70 feet difference in the throw. Wouldn't you say, Jeremy?
Oh, at least 70 on some, if not more.
And then it also would change the line at which you could approach the basket and really oftentimes making it vastly more difficult from the pro tees. So maybe it wasn't as straight a shot towards the basket, or there were more obstacles like trees and things in the park in your way.
So the three amateurs, we played best throw. So we all threw for our drive, and whoever had the best landing spot is where we would all throw from our next section for our next throw.
And it was like the team score. So if it took us combined three shots to get there, we took a three, which might have been a par or whatever. So we had the benefit of having two terrible throws and just relying on at least one of us to make a decent throw.
And Jeremy was stuck traditional.
So. By himself.
By himself. Pro tees, no pro gimmies, tees no mulligans.
Pro tees versus amateur tees. He's on his own, and we're playing best ball is how you describe it.
We did help him look for one of his discs. Every other throw he had was
sportsmanship. And what was the result, Mike? Who came out on top?
Nobody.
We tied.
We tied.
So how much better is Jeremy than any one of us at disc golf? I think the answer is significantly better than any one of us. Because even with taking our best shots from closer and easier range, he still tied us. And so we did decide that we're going to go give it another try at some point. To see if we play from the same tees, what's the result? If we play from the front tees, he plays from the front tees, back tees. But to me, it was a good time. Jeremy, you're good, man. Like, when you throw that thing off the tee, that is a serious-looking shot. I wish I could throw it like that.
Yeah, it looks like it comes out of a launcher.
It does. It doesn't even look right. Out. So, Jeremy, how long have you been playing disc golf?
Let's see. I have been playing disc golf since probably around 2000, 2001, somewhere in there.
Okay. Almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years, yeah.
Okay. Mike, and how long have you played? Because you and I have played before together, several times, actually.
Oh, I want to say maybe 3 years, but we took a year off.
Yeah, yeah. And I had
played a little bit longer. Maybe 4 years, we took a year off.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. And I played a little bit when I was on the East Coast, but not very much. There was a place I'd go to once a year that had baskets that I ended up buying discs so I could play once a year. And then I played in a park one other time maybe before coming to Indiana 7 years ago, back to Indiana, I should say. And then I haven't really – then it was the times that we've played together. So you've got a few years on us, Jeremy, that's for sure.
Just a few.
Now, Jeremy, you also played for club team right here when you were a Purdue student?
Yeah, while I was here at Purdue, I played for our collegiate team.
And as you phrased it, I think that was the last time they were good.
Yeah, that was the way I phrased it. When myself and the team I was on was with Purdue, we managed, I can't remember if it was two or three top 10 finishes at the Collegiate Nationals.
That's great. Now you have said you held a record of some sort. Is that true?
Yeah, for about 3 years running, I held the national collegiate distance record, and it was at 582 feet officially measured.
So you threw a disc 582 feet officially measured with like whatever conditions are acceptable for having a record. Mike.
Yes.
If, on your best throw, how far do you think you throw one?
So do you measure how much it goes in the air or where it lands from where you start? Those are two different numbers.
For distance competitions, it is actually where it touches the ground the first time is the end of the flight.
200 maybe?
Yeah, like I feel like on a very good throw, I throw 200, maybe 250. And Jeremy, you almost had it at 600 feet.
Yeah.
And now you know why we made him play the pro team. So I'm a big fan of disc golf as a recreational activity, not necessarily as a competitive activity. And I think that's one of the important things that our listeners should know is, and Jeremy, talk a little bit about this for us, because anybody can go out there and play all sorts of different competitive levels just for fun, different athletic levels. Like you play in some local communities and you see skill levels of all type, right?
Oh yeah, I've seen the pure beginner who came out with a putter and didn't know what they had that we had to loan disc to guys like myself that just carry a cart because it's too heavy to carry all their discs. So,
and Jim played with us. Jim, are you muted? Can you actually jump on real quick, Jim?
Yeah.
Hey, Jim. So hey. This was your first time playing, right?
Oh yeah, I've had a disc for about 10 years and I never. Never had the opportunity to use it.
So this was your first time. So did you, let me ask you this. Did you enjoy it?
I did. Yeah. I think I enjoyed it more than I was expecting to, which might've been why it took me 10 years to make it out. But no, I enjoyed it.
And we played, as Mike, you were describing, we played the best throw. And at any given time, we at least played throws from all of us on the team. Jim, we played some of Jim's throws.
Not as many. But we did.
Maybe not as many. You're right, Jim. It was your first time out. There was a couple throws that maybe you could have. We
I had one that almost went behind us.
You did. That's okay. That's okay. But I think that's one of the great things
about
disc
golf. I think
you
almost killed a kid at a playground once.
I think that's the great thing about disc golf is because you can go out there and you don't have to be good to necessarily enjoy yourself.
Absolutely.
Mike, Mike, what would you say are some of the other like kind of things that you think are good or, you know, fun about disc golf in general?
I mean, so you do get activity outside. I mean, that's it's always good to have activities, things that you can do to get some exercise. I find as I've gotten older, I've gotten more stagnant. So
yeah,
when I can find something to do, it's not house chores or things like that that gets me outside. I think that's always a benefit. It's also, you know, it's not that expensive.
No, it's not like affordable. Ball golf. I mean, I don't know.
Maybe if I'm buying 40 discs.
Right. But even then, a ball golf, you're going to be in for a decent set of clubs. What are you going to be in for $300-$400 for a good set or a decent set? Plus, you got greens fees, $70 probably with a cart. I mean, you can get some twilight hours. You can join some small country clubs or stuff that it's cheaper. But ball golf is really expensive. No fees to get on. You were kind of describing that, Mike. And Jeremy, how many – you've probably played in, I don't know, 100 courses. How many have you ever had to pay for a course? That's pretty rare, right?
It is pretty rare. There are courses that I have paid to play and would totally pay again to play. A lot of times those are on people's private properties or they really just – for the upkeep of the course. There's a lot that goes into them that people don't realize.
But the courses we have locally, there's no charge. So we have, Murdoch Park in Lafayette. We have the Washout in the Woods, which are both city parks as well. And you can go pretty close, like Camp Column. I don't think that has – is that how you say that one, Jeremy?
Camp Column.
Yeah, and that doesn't – so there's – I don't know. In our small area, there's 4, 5, 6 probably places to play that have no cost.
I can think of 8 or 9.
Yeah, so you would. I can think of 4 or 5. So I think that's really important. And what's it like average disc cost, Mike? For me, I probably spend anywhere from 10 to 15 per disc. Well, and I probably only need 3 to get started.
I guess it depends because there are some really good resale shops. So a lot of people will use a disc for a period of time and then decide that they maybe their style has changed or they've improved. So they trade in, and so they'll sell it for, you know, whatever small cost, and the resale shop will then resell that, you know, at a discounted rate. So you can
maybe actually over $4 or $5 or something.
Pretty good set of equipment for, you know, fairly cheap. But I probably spent $10 a disc, maybe a little bit less.
Jeremy, what do you usually like? Is $15 kind of your high average? Maybe
$15 to $17. You're going to get the better plastic. It's going to last you longer.
Okay, so let's get into what is a disc then. So we get the game is it's like regular ball golf for those of you that know what that is, and you're going low score, throw it towards the basket, fewest shots. Mike, I think you got that pretty well explained. But tell us about the discs. Like, what? Why are there so many different ones? Why do you feel obligated to carry 30? What do the numbers mean on those discs?
How do these discs differentiate from just a traditional frisbee?
Yeah,
things like that.
Well. You know, you mentioned ball golf and having all those clubs, the drivers and your putters and wedges. And disc golf is really a lot like that. There's 4 main classifications of disc. You have what's called a high-speed driver, a fairway driver, a mid-range, and a putter. And as you can kind of tell from the name, a high-speed driver is supposed to fly really fast and theoretically go the furthest. A fairway driver is going to be a little bit slower than that. You'll have a little more control, and it's not going to fly quite as far. Mid-ranges, same thing as high-speed to fairway. We're going to slow it down a little more, have a little more control, and again, not fly quite as far as a fairway driver. And then finally, your putter is going to be fairly blunt for the most control and really the shortest range throws. Now, when we compare these to regular old Frisbees, as we'd say, a lot of people would call that like an ultimate disc as a regular old Frisbee. They're regular old Frisbees, bigger, rounder, not rounder, like around, but on the edge.
Edge, yeah.
More around. Yes, they're all circles for discs. Yeah. but your golf discs are going to have more wing shapes on the edge. And that wing shape is really what helps characterize the flight of the disc.
So what are the numbers? Like if you buy an Innova disc, which is a popular brand, they come with 4 numbers. What are those numbers about?
They mean absolutely nothing. No, I'm just So the first number there is the speed. And when you hear speed, all you think is, oh, it's going to fly fast. But that is not correct. That is actually – the speed that it's supposed to fly. So if it's a high speed driver, it's going to have like a 12 on there. That disc is supposed to fly really fast to for all the rest of the numbers to make sense.
So it means you have to throw it faster.
You have to throw it faster. And gotcha. If it's not flying at that speed, then the rest of the numbers are irrelevant.
Right, because it won't maintain its characteristics.
It won't hold those characteristics. The next characteristic, it's one of my favorite, is glide. And this is the reason I only throw fairway drivers and mid-ranges. It's because they have so much glide compared to any other disc. And the control. So I love the glide. That's how long it stays in the air.
So it's propensity to stay in the air is the glide, yes. The second number.
That's
what's
exactly
a, right. What's a high number on that one?
High number, going to be like a 5. You might see a 6 every once in a while, but a 5 would be really good. Next, we have the turn. And this is where it starts to get confusing. So I'm going to say a right-hand backhand player, which means you're throwing across your body like you would a backhand in tennis.
And like a normal frisbee throw.
Yeah, like a normal frisbee throw. That's a good way to put it. And the turn usually ranges from +1 to -2. And the more negative it is, the more likely a disc is to turn to the right at high speeds. So based on those high speeds, that's what the speed of the disc is, right? So if you're closer to that speed of the disc, it's more likely to turn right. If you go over that speed of the disc and it's, say, like a -1, it's really going to turn right extra because you're going over speed.
And when I throw a disc, it naturally, for me, because of the way I throw it poorly, it wants to turn left. And that's how most people would throw it, correct?
I disagree. I think we just need to work on your form a little bit.
Well, I know that's the case. Hey, there's no doubt about that. I was getting my hips out in front, folks. I don't even know. Like, I was spilling my water. He was saying stuff I don't quite understand, but we'll get it down.
Yeah, no, some of the issue comes to beginners buying discs that they shouldn't buy.
Right.
And I think some of your discs might actually be a little too stable advanced. For your arm. Yeah.
Too advanced for me.
Exactly. Yeah. That last number, though, the fourth number is the fade, and that's the propensity of the disc to come back left and how hard it's going to try. So all discs, really, if thrown correctly or light enough or strong enough, will make an S-curve flight, no matter what disc it is. But it's just a matter of how broad that S goes and how much it comes back.
So as the resident left-hander, when we talk about those last two numbers, do I just flip the directions?
Yes, you just flip the directions.
Okay.
Mike's a left-hander. He's the minority in the group here, and it's a right-handed world he lives in, that's for sure.
I only called him a cheater once while we were playing.
Yeah, right. So you described how the discs fly, and then there's different plastics. Like, there's better quality plastics, lower quality plastics. But now, if we take all that aside, and we said if somebody out there listening wants to grab a disc or two, what would be the like a good recommended disc or two just to go out and get started? What would you say they should buy, Jeremy? And we're not sponsored. You're not sponsored, I don't think.
No, I am not sponsored currently.
And so just give our listeners an idea. Like, go out, look for this and this, and go out and knock yourself out.
I would say a Speed 7 driver, something like a Leopard, would be perfect. And you want one with a -1 or a -2 turn. Just because throwing right hand, backhand initially, you're going to be a little weak as a beginner. That is the strongest throw a player can have, though. So even though it might feel weak at first, it's going to develop. But a slower speed driver, a lot of people go out and buy like speed 12s things and think they can throw them, and then their form just is terrible. Right. So I feel bad for those people, but
I've done it. Like, I have a disc like that a leopard. Okay, a Leopard. I have a disc that was a 12 because I thought, oh, this would go faster. No, it would.
It goes
I would
further because it's faster. Exactly.
I would chuck it straight into the ground because I couldn't throw it properly.
Yeah, I always recommend a Leopard though as the go-to. Okay.
And what if you need like a putter then? Just a one putter and a driver, and you're good to go.
I would actually probably go with a mid-range a slower mid-range instead of a putter, just to kind of give you a little more options other than putting. You can use it off the tee if you need to as you get going. And then from there, we'll branch into the high speed and the putters.
Do you have a recommendation on a mid-range? So you say Leopard for your low-end, slower, slightly slower driver. What about a mid-range?
Mid-range, I will always recommend a rock.
Rock. Like an actual rock.
I thought you had to use a disc. Okay. Yeah. ROC, right?
ROC. Yes.
Yeah. Man, and those are made by Nova.
Throat rounds.
I know. So what I wanted to do was start chucking rocks at Jeremy while he was throwing to try to level the playing field further, but that didn't really go. Okay. So you only need a couple discs. You recommend a Leopard and maybe a rock. And if they pick up a putter, great. If not, just go out there and practice without. Really low barrier of entry, because most of the courses in our – well, most of the courses that I've ever heard of don't really cost money. So you can get out. You could search online for them. That's how I find courses. Just do a search for disc golf course near me. That's one way.
That's Purdue a good way.
Yeah, Purdue has a disc golf course. They used to have two. I think they're down to one. And I don't think the baskets are up right now because of COVID. But they actually have a course that I enjoy playing on Slater Hill.
There's actually a couple apps that are really handy for finding courses.
What are those?
There's a Disc Golf Course Review.
Okay.
Which will help not only help you find a course, but a lot of people will rate courses on there. So you'll get a good idea of what you're going to, if it's wooded or open,
right,
or what kind of hazards. And then UDisc is the other.
I use UDisc. Okay. Yeah, I've used that one. Now, we should also say, when you go to these courses, you're not going to check in at the clubhouse and sign in. There's nobody there. These are just parks that you walk into yourself almost always. And you have to – so you'll want to know the map of the course if you can, if it's not clearly marked especially, because not all courses are created equal.
Definitely. And that's where Disc Golf Course Review and UDisc come in really handy as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you have to find kind of your launch location, which is your tee box, and kind of know where to go, where the pin is, because you can't, or the basket, because you can't always see it either. Sometimes it's around a bend or whatever. So good to try to familiarize yourself with the course before you get out there. And so producer Jim sent us a question in the chat, where to buy discs locally. So if you're local to the Purdue community, I can tell you two places I like to buy discs are both local places. One is the Discount Den. Actually, if you're a Purdue person, you definitely know Den Pops and Discount Den. And they have a small selection of discs, and I love to support the local business. And the other local business, Jeremy, help me with the name of it. I always forget. It's like Plastic to the People.
That's correct. Plastic to the People.
And they have weird hours, so check them out online.
Very, very strange hours, but if you get in there, they got a good selection.
Yeah, and the guy, I don't know the guy's name or anything, but he's super, I'm sure you do, Jeremy, super nice guy. He'll definitely help you if you tell him you're just getting started.
Yeah, they're often open on Saturdays. Otherwise, they work regular jobs. But that's the best place to get used discs, that, like Mike was talking about.
And I think you can get – there's used discs if you have like a play-it-again sports type place in your town. So if you're in the Indianapolis area, I know like up in the Carmel area, there's a – which is a north suburb of Indianapolis, for those that are not in the area, you can, like, there's Play It Again Sports and stuff like that. They'll sell discs sometimes. And then you can get some at the big box stores, like Dick's will carry it as well.
So we talked about a lot about the sport, or the activity, how you want to look at it. I guess one thing I'd be curious to know, Jeremy, with your years of activity in this sport, is what is the worst injury you've ever seen as a result?
The worst injury I have ever seen, someone taking a disc to the face, just not paying attention to where their surroundings were, people yelling for, and it coming in right on the eyebrow. I mean, your skin's real thin there, and it just pops right open.
Yummy.
Yeah.
And you bleed something terrible from those types of injuries too. And I will tell you that the edges on, especially your drivers, come, like you said, that they're wing shaped. They come to a pretty good point. And thrown by someone that's competent, they're really screaming.
Oh, yes. They can move.
I can imagine quite the gash. That's pretty nasty. So, but I would say this, that the people that I've run across out on disc golf courses or in the disc golf community, if you will, they seem to be kind of a great community. Can you tell the listeners, Jeremy, like what type of people you see out there, kind of what's the mentality? Because if you're like, I don't want to golf, it's all people in funny pants and they're kind of snobby, that's not disc golf. If you have that be the ball. No, so what's the community like, Jeremy?
With disc golfers, the biggest part of the community is people who just enjoy being outdoors.
Yeah.
But also enjoy having some nature around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's an attitude that comes with that type of people. Most of the people I play with will carry a trash bag and help clean up the course or the park nice. As they play. So it's your very nature friendly type people who are usually pretty relaxed.
Yeah, I find that they're pretty relaxed. And one of the big things they want is just more people to play. Like they actually want to encourage people into the game. So they don't mind if you're an amateur or if you're just starting off, they still want you to join into their clubs or into whatever. Cause we have a local disc golf club here in town. And I've heard people there say, just come on out. It doesn't matter how good you are. If it's your first time, we'll get you paired up. You'll get, you know, help you learn fast. And they want more people to play the game. Now, Jeremy, you were telling us before we started about a disc that you had lost that years ago or something, and somebody found it. I thought that spoke really well to the community. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was at a tournament as part of the Indiana Summer Series down at Pride's Creek in southern Indiana, and this was in 2015, and it was one of my favorite Firebirds. I let it go, and as soon as I saw it flying, I knew it was a terrible shot. And it ended up in the middle of the pond, and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm never getting this thing back. And this morning, I look at my phone. There's a call coming in from an unknown number. Almost didn't answer it, but I was like, you know what? I'll answer it. So I pick it up, and the guy is like, is this Zach? I said, no, I think you have the wrong number. And he says, wait, hold on. I might have said the wrong name. I was like, what? I got the number off a disc I found. And I was like, oh, I'm Jeremy. He's like, yes. I found a disc that might be yours. And I'm like, where? Okay.
Where
are you? and
just
where are you?
$200 in my PayPal account. And,
you know. Exactly. And I was like, wait, is it yellow? Is it a Firebird? And I got so excited because he answered yes to both of those. And I knew exactly which disc it was. One of my favorites. But he and his friend were just out playing, and the waters were so low. One of them had a bad shot. They were trying to retrieve it and ended up pulling mine out along with like six others. And they were trying to call people who had their numbers on the back to get them returned to the rightful owners.
Yeah, and this was after years and that's not local either, right?
That's some exactly. Exceptional permanent marker.
Yeah, that is a pretty good. That is a pretty good Sharpie, bro.
It was actually 5 years ago yesterday that I lost.
5 years ago, and not in town either. It was somewhere else, right?
No, about 3 hours away.
Yeah, 3 hours away. That's I think that speaks to the community. I think it's a fun group. The people seem to just want to have fun, and it's one of the reasons I like disc golf because we can just go out and have a good time. So.
Oh, it's great, and the more the merrier.
Well, Jeremy, thanks for joining and lending your expertise. Thanks for taking the time out last week and having a round with a few amateurs and giving us tips. And even though those tips might have cost you the victory, of course, if it was a little more of a level playing field, I think we lose. But I'm ready to try again. I don't know about you, Mike.
Absolutely. And I'll keep taking those free pro tips.
All right, Mike. Well, you know what? We have gone into long form on this episode. This
I think we might be in a part one, part two scenario.
Nah, I think we've just gone into long form. That's all right. You know, it's a summer series. We're only doing it once a month. So this is our July episode. If you're just now listening to it, we'll have another episode in August. Then we'll be back on regular schedule come the fall semester where we're doing our weekly episodes and we'll trim them down a little bit. But I hope our listeners found this to be an exciting, interesting episode. We talked about Snowden movie. We talked about 3D printing as our cyber summer project. And of course, we just got done with Jeremy here talking about disc golf, which I think is a great activity. Encourage all of our listeners, if you're looking for an outside activity for the summer and going into the fall, try disc golf. It's easy to get into. It's a lot of fun. And I think you'll enjoy it. And you don't have to be great to have fun. So thanks to Jeremy. Thanks to Matthew for joining us. We're going to wrap this episode up. As always, we'd love to hear from you. CyberTapPodcast@purdue.edu. Shoot us an email. As always, we'd appreciate follows and subscribes and give us a rating on Apple if you listen to us there. And we'll talk to you next time. Thanks, everyone.
One more summer episode, everybody. So look forward to it.